In part A, the relational foundations of learning, Linda Darling Hammond and Bart Pianta made the developmental case. They demonstrated that relationships shape attention, motivation, identity, and cognitive growth. They reminded us that community regulates stress, that psychological safety expands intellectual risk-taking, and that variability among learners is the norm, not the exception. In part B, from developmental science to systemic design, we widen the lens by listening to these two international experts who both served as deans of schools of education and who both have the ability to synthesize information from a multitude of sources and apply it. Precisely the capacities we want all students to develop. If the realities that Bob and Linda talk about are true, what must change in how we prepare teachers, in how we measure success, in how we structure schools? What would it be to hold systems accountable, not only for outcomes, but for the conditions that make deep learning possible? What would it mean to professionalize teaching around developmental expertise rather than compliance? Part B, from developmental science to systemic design, turns from principle to architecture, from understanding to redesign. We know more than we once did about how human beings learn. We have the evidence. We have the tools. What remains is alignment. Will we build systems that reflect what we know? Let us turn to Part B, from developmental science to systemic design. Linda, EdUtopia is filled with some rich opportunities, and they include pieces you did with Pam Cantor and the Science of Learning and Development Alliance and CASEL on how children learn. You were one of the people who came together and said, we have to do something to bring together what we know about learning and development. You're the lead author on the implications of the science of learning and development for education practice, and another piece for teachers. How important is what we know about the science of learning and development to this work, and what are its practical implications?
That's a huge question.
I know. Unfortunately, you're going to be back again, so you're going to have other opportunities.
Yeah, that's a really long article, which is skimming the iceberg, but it's foundational. I think it's what Bob and I are talking about. It is the foundation of effective teaching and effective development, right? We want young people to grow up not only to be smart and cognitively capable, we want them also to be kind, compassionate, productive human beings, right? All of that is rooted in what we're learning. Bob gave a great example of some of the neuroscience findings as we're measuring people's brainwaves and watching them, which reinforce what many people have known for a long time. If you go back and read John Dewey or any number of other theorists, Maria Montessori, you will see these same principles, but we have a lot more evidence now that basically show us that, first of all, the brain is very plastic. It continues to develop throughout life. Even at my age, I'm still making new neural connections, as are we all. Those are a function of relationships, particularly supportive developmental relationships and experiences that are stimulating and give us the opportunity to inquire and put things together. Brains are very unique and individual. That variability is like the norm. And all of this comes together to tell us that the way we designed schools 100 years ago was deeply flawed in its understanding of how human beings learn and develop. We also know that trauma has effects, the ways in which the brain is flooded with either cortisol and stress hormones, or on the other hand, oxytocin makes us feel safe and secure. It makes a difference in neural development, intelligences that we develop. We know that the way we develop cognitively is also informed by physical activity, sleep, being in green spaces, opportunities for mindfulness. There's a lot that we know about what enables productive thinking, development, and learning. And if we were to design schools based on what we know from the science, and we have design principles for schools that spell this out, you would design schools to support these productive relationships, to provide a safe environment for learning, psychologically safe, as well as physically safe, to create the kinds of learning opportunities that allow for inquiry and curiosity and the pursuit of the answers to meaningful questions, to provide the explicit development of social and emotional habits and skills and mindsets. That's actually a part of the curriculum, to provide the supports that students need, health and mental health supports and opportunities for academic engagement, tutoring, and small group work, so that you're figuring out ways to enable students to meet and overcome barriers. When you go to Finland, they've built the support system in completely integrated into the way you do school. You don't have to go get an IEP and a 504 plan and meet with different people and go through a 2-year process to get extra supports. As soon as the need is identified, you get the supports that you need to be whole and healthy. We have a lot of education policy based on a punitive approach, the No Child Left Behind policy framework, which is based on cascading punishments and the assumption that adults would not work on behalf of children unless you threatened them with blowing up their school or firing them or not paying them as much money. So we were just talking about how teacher well-being translates into student well-being, but you built a whole system on kids being stressed, adults being stressed, fearing punishments, which we know restricts the amount of learning that can go on, restricts the amount of community that can be built. This is critically important at the level of the teacher and student, student to student, the classroom and the school and the system as a whole, that we build a system designed to enable people to develop and learn in the way we naturally learn and develop.
Bob, you have done so much work on classroom conditions for learning and what happens when the things Linda is talking about are happening and when they're not happening. I would ask you to elaborate and talk about some of the practical takeaways as Linda has as well.
Much of what I'm going to say is will echo what Linda just described about thinking about education not as different than human development, but as a means of helping foster development and steer it. Unless you're anchored in a deep understanding of human development, and the curriculum is anchored in it, and the teacher training is anchored in it, and the policies are anchored in it, then your system of education is going to be fundamentally misaligned with what we know about human development. This is going to be a little editorial, but I think one of the biggest examples of this misalignment around policies and practices in education has been the way that we treated students when they came back from the pandemic shutdowns. Consider the way that we thought about kids and their needs re-entering school after the shutdown. We had reams of data showing the kids were disengaged, disinterested, depressed, showing all sorts of mental health problems. They lost people back home. And our solution, when we were trying to invite them back in, was to double down on more intense, more academically focused lessons and performance metrics and experiences in the classrooms. When these kids really needed something very different, they needed a relationship that expressed an understanding of their situation. They needed empathy. And that should have been the on-ramp back to school. That's my editorial. But it describes an instance of this misalignment in a very real way that mattered for kids. And no surprise, we now have lingering effects on student engagement and student attendance. One of the things I mentioned from the work that I've done with Howard Blumenthal, interviewing the kids around the world for a book, is this way that we distilled these observations into three fundamental understandings about human development and its connection to learning. So first, authentic learning happens when it's oh, okay. Start. First, schools have to make learning relevant. If you want learning to be deep and authentic, it has to be relevant to the learner. Second, you have to recognize that there's a relational substrate to learning, that relationships are connected with cognition, and that relationships and thinking are going to vary across students, and that's the norm, not the exception. And third, authentic learning of the type we want for our kids is active. Kids need to experience engagement through activity and agency. So, from a classroom perspective, though, what we see so often in our own observations, in my own work and others, is that teachers feel completely straitjacketed by a system that basically tells them, here you've got 25 kids in this classroom, you're the math teacher. If you're lucky, you might get a good math curriculum, but mostly you're going to get a set of pacing guides that are going to press you through a set of activities so that these kids can perform on a test of basic proficiency standards. So, what we've done, instead of fostering learning, we've created a system for management of learning. We haven't created learning. This management model is superimposed as kind of a one-size-fits-all approach across all kids, even when we know that learning is variable across every single one of them. So this disconnect creates an enormous amount of pain for educators and the kids who are being educated. I think figuring out how to realign or correct the misalignment is really the task of creating a better future for our kids and for our schools. I think of this in terms of a couple different steps. First, we need to think about how we must do a better job of measuring the conditions of learning. So if we really care about the classroom conditions that foster learning, we ought to measure them. We can do that through observation, spending time in classrooms, surveying kids, interviewing teachers, getting them to describe the kind of emotional supports that are present in the classroom, the way teachers organize the classroom, and how teachers stimulate kids' cognition. We do that through observation, and then we give that data back to teachers in a way that's relevant to them. In this way, teachers can begin to see how their work in the classroom engages kids more deeply in learning. But think about what we actually measure in education. We must have somewhere in the order of billions of data points on kids' performance on academic multiple choice tests, and almost no data points that systematically describe the actual conditions of learning that kids experience. We measure teachers' degrees. We measure the number of kids in the class. We might even measure the kind of curriculum that's being used, but all those are distal to the kids' actual experience in the classroom. But one of the things that's really exciting to me, and we've seen this in our work over and over again, is that when we move into studying and observing the actual processes and interactions that kids experience and teachers experience to level them up and elevate them more systematically, you begin to start seeing the classroom unfold as kind of an activated context for development. Let me give you a couple of examples. So we've worked with a coaching model with teachers to try to call attention to the way that teachers interact with students in their classrooms. We've done this with kids in pre-K, we've done it with kids from high school. So we did a particular study with teachers of secondary age kids, 8th grade to 12th grade, across four different content areas. And we coached those teachers simply to pay attention to their interactions with students, and to try to take the kids' perspective on the students' own learning. Try to for teachers to understand how kids were viewing their own learning and interactions with the teachers. So the teachers would tell us about halfway through this coaching program, after they'd seen videos of their own teaching, that slowing down to focus on a student's perspective was very hard and was not an easy thing for teachers to do. Not because they can't see the cues, but because they know what they need to do is to give the kids more responsibility for their learning. That's what was hard for teachers. Teachers would say, I have to give up control. It's so hard. And so the coaching helps scaffold them through that process of kind of perspective taking and then giving up control. So what was really interesting about this is that the students, as teachers begin to make these changes in their own mindset and behavior, become much more engaged, and the classroom becomes a much more lively two-way environment. And not surprisingly to us, I think surprisingly to many of the teachers, the students in the classrooms where teachers were receiving this coaching scored 10 percentile points higher on average on the state assessments across all content areas, across all four content areas. So what happened was we supported this relational resource in the classroom that had nothing to do with the content that the teachers were teaching, but by adjusting the way that teachers delivered the content, the kids' scores went up on the high stakes content test. So I think, this is an example of the importance of elevating information about relationships and interactions in the classroom and the real conditions that teachers and students experience. And when we can elevate and describe that information in a way that's understandable, that's acceptable, that's felt as supported and not supportive and not punitive, that orients itself for both for the teacher to begin to shift her behavior in ways that are far more active and far more engaging to students. This evidence, doesn't come just from our own work, but studies all around the world are very strong about the importance of teacher-student interactions and relationships and the value that teachers' perspective taking on student learning plays in the improvement and fostering of positive relationships. And I think, the more we pay attention to real processes that are active in our classrooms on a much more systematic basis, the more hope I have for a large-scale improvement.
I just want to piggyback on the point that Bob is making that both kids have to have agency and engagement in their learning and that they're not standardized. So there's been this attempt for what Lee Shulman used to call the remote control of teaching, which is that you define the standards, you get the pacing guide, you standardize, and those Common Core standards are now being delivered in that way in so many places. And then teachers have this terrible dilemma because they're supposed to teach to the children, but then they're supposed to keep up with the pacing guide, which sometimes gets as ridiculous as to have scripts attached to it. And one of the things that's fundamentally ironic is that the more we try to standardize instruction in that way, the more we promote inequality. Because there are kids who are bored and not getting what they need. Other kids are falling behind. They fall more and more behind. It's a really interesting study that was done by New Classrooms looking at if you allow teachers to find where kids are mathematically and teach to where they are and accelerate their progress, as compared to when you require teachers to teach the grade level standards, you get 5 times greater learning gains. If you teach kids where they are and allow them to progress, than you do if you just march through the grade level standards. And we know this. We've got lots of studies. If you go back to Benjamin Bloom's mastery learning studies in the 1980s, you will find the same findings. And yet the policy system continues to try to standardize the approach, holding teachers accountable for doing things that are essentially malpractice. And that creates a deep dilemma for teachers. It contributes to teacher attrition. Smart people don't want to be in a system in which they cannot be effective because they're being held to a set of assumptions that are deeply flawed. So this is very fundamental and a huge problem for us to tackle. As Bob said, if you give teachers the opportunity and kids to engage in the real learning activity, you get much better outcomes. And how do we get policymakers to let go of the process unless you deeply prepare the professionals so you can trust them and step back and let them do the work? If you try to micromanage what they do, you're going to chase people out of the profession. And we've got to learn that lesson in this
Yeah,
country.
I could not agree more. And I'd make a couple of observations here. I don't think our systems, our educational systems, appreciate appreciate the natural variation among kids and accept it as a real thing and move along with that variation to help all kids feel appreciated and learn what they're capable of learning. Rather, I think we've created these, as we've created these systems for management of learning, we've kind of created greater inequalities. We see in schools some kids are not, we describe them as really not capable of learning, or they're only capable of learning if I am the teacher directing them in a very specific way. But if we follow those kids outside of school, I can bet you, and we have countless of examples of this in the book that Howard and I worked on, that those kids who the schools label as not so capable of learning are extraordinarily capable of learning complex and challenging tasks and doing so in a way that's authentic, deep, and rigorous. And so I think we have to ask ourselves, what's the disconnect between what's happening outside of school and what may or may not be happening inside of school in terms of the ways what's offered to kids and the opportunities that are given to kids are drawing them in and connecting with them. And the differences that they have between each other are not a big deal. The differences simply just get expressed through a different path toward learning that's relevant and rigorous. So I think we need to be thinking about what are the conditions that are enabling this kind of learning and engagement outside of school, and whether we can transport that into school. And I would add here the importance of students' voice as one of those conditions. Linda mentioned this, and I want to reinforce it here. And it goes by a lot of different terms, but youth voice is really essential for their own learning. We do a lot of projects in middle school, and everybody likes to characterize middle school as kind of this Bermuda Triangle, like where kids go in and they disappear and they come out somewhere else, a few years later in high school. But youth voice actually transforms middle schools from the Bermuda Triangle into agents where real development's taking place and real learning is taking place. It's abundantly evident in schools in which fifth and sixth and seventh graders are surveyed about the things that they're interested in, or they're participating in the groups and the governing groups of the school. They're determining some of what the curriculum looks like. They feel like they've got a real and authentic role to play in determining what their school experience is going to be and what they're going to learn. And then, lo and behold, when given that opportunity, they roll up their sleeves and they get to work and they learn. It's remarkable and it's all too rare.
Barb, what are your takeaways from this conversation, and what are its implications for teachers today?
That's the big one. We have not privileged relationships. We have not made them as explicit as they need to be in our systems of education in K-12 classrooms around the country, or in places where discussion takes place around policy, in the tools that teachers are given in order to build relationships, and in our teacher preparation programs. All of those different contexts, we have not elevated relationships and made them a priority. So honestly, it's not surprising to me that what we see happening and what's so distressing in many of our public school systems is the leaching of human capital and human energy out of education systems. We have a problem with attendance, with kids being engaged in their class or in their schools, and we have a problem with teacher retention. And I'd say that in some ways, those problems expressed by kids and by teachers are a sign that they're voting with their feet a little bit. And I think their message is that the future of our educational enterprise has got to come to grips with the fundamental reality of the importance of relationships to that enterprise, and to begin first gradually and then very systematically and programmatically to preserve what we can do well in support of relationships, and then make very strategic and systematic moves and investments so that every single day teachers can take advantage of the small micro interactions that are meaningful to kids and meaningful to teachers. And at the same time, policymakers are being guided by not just test scores, but by the value of the social and relational experiences that kids are having with teachers. And honestly, the best thing I think teachers can do with kids is just get to know them.
Linda, do you have any closing points you would like to make?
A lot of what we're talking about in the importance of relationships and these modes of learning comes to the feet of the teacher, if you will. We need to worry about deep investments in teacher preparation, but we should not blame teachers because they're in a system that needs to change. And we have to take responsibility for creating the system in which teachers can be effective, productive, caring, as well as competent. And where we do that, we see transformative outcomes for kids and for teachers. We see the elimination of teacher shortages. We see teachers wanting to be there and staying. We see kids wanting to come to school and being there. And we need to learn from those places and take the lessons for what the transformation of the system needs to look like.
Let me sum up part of our conversation by sharing with the president of the California State Board of Education a story from California about the opposite of what Linda Darling Hammond and her colleagues are doing. When I was leading the evaluation of the CASEL Initial 8 District SEL initiative, I interviewed leaders and teachers in Oakland and in Sacramento. And in both cases, I heard early on about the toll that was taken when the state had taken over the schools and demanded a type of approach to reading, which we now know did not work, but where they could not address the elements of the whole child and the individuality that both of you've talked about. 2 years later, I was in Sac City. I was site visiting a first grade class that was doing the seven characteristics of effective students. And I was hearing first graders talk about being proactive. And I asked the teacher, saying, "You've been here a long time. How do you feel about what is happening in the district now regarding social emotional learning and focusing on the child?" And she looked at me and her eyes teared up and she said, "This is the last year of my teaching because I'm retired. And I am so grateful that I can finally do what I wanted to do and I knew what was necessary to do if I was going to be able to teach these students." And I think that connects to the position that we tend to place teachers when we are countering the human component that, as Bob had mentioned earlier, contribute to why teachers can contribute to students' learning through their humanity, and at the same time, the needs of students. I thank you both for very rich conversations.
There's a river flowing in my soul. There's a river flowing in my soul, and it's somebody. There's a